guns too big for their own good. Today, Friday, August 15th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Iraq War vet Philip Carter served in Bakuba. He can't believe the cops in Ferguson are carrying the same weapons he did in Iraq.
I think there's a sense that this isn't the country we fought to protect. There's something jarring about seeing the same force you used as part of an occupation used at home.
And a Yazidi woman in Lincoln, Nebraska, tries to help her friends and relatives surrounded by Islamic militants in Iraq.
Right now we're trying to help all the Yazidis get out of Iraq because Middle East is no longer a place for Yazidis.
And an immigration attorney in Texas and why illegal immigrants keep trying to get back to the U.S.
You take me away from my kids and tell me that I can't cross this line, damn straight I'm going to cross that line.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. On two stories that we've been following, there's a sense of calm today. Palestinians and Israelis are not shooting rockets at each other. They're talking. Not directly, but as we'll hear later on The World, they are talking. And in Ferguson, Missouri today, also a sense of calm. And we'll kick off proceedings today on The World with the Ferguson story, specifically how Ferguson's cops have the weapons and armor like soldiers in Iraq. That's not me saying that. That's the title of a new item in the Daily Beast. Ferguson's cops are armed like I was in Iraq, writes Philip Carter. He's a former Army captain and now a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security in Washington. So, Philip, seriously, you think the cops deployed in Missouri are as well tooled up as you were in downtown Bakuba in 2005 and 2006?
Well, not quite as well tooled up. They don't have the on-call artillery and helicopters we did. But in terms of what they're carrying, it's almost exactly the same gear, the same body armor, the same rifles, and in some cases, the same vehicles.
There were a lot of soldiers, as I recall, writing home for Kevlar vests and special skins for Humvees in the early days of the invasion. One tweet I saw recently was from a guy who was part of the invasion in 2003 in Iraq, and he said the cops in Ferguson have better kit than he had. Is that plausible?
It's plausible, but it's not the point to see the real one-to-one comparison. The point is that it's to point out the absurdity of the militarized response in Ferguson, that, you know, this is not a war zone. These are not insurgents. These are our own people. And the police there ought not use the same level of force and response we did in Iraq.
If I pull back and kind of just look at what you and other vets were writing online, I get a sense that there's a feeling that this heavy arming is a bad thing, at least for a police department.
Yeah, I think there's a sense that this isn't the country we fought to protect, that we don't want to see our streets become war zones, and that there's something jarring about seeing the same force you used as part of an occupation used at home, whether it's in Ferguson or Los Angeles or any other city around the country.
Some of the criticism, as you know, is not just about how the police, like in Ferguson, are equipped. It's what they're doing with these guns as well. On one Storify thread that I read, more than one vet spoke out against the cops for pointing their weapons right at protesters. Tell us what the problem is with that.
The problem with this kind of military response is it really chills speech. And what you have in Ferguson is a protest where Americans ought to be able to peaceably assemble and redress their grievances towards government. And when you have a very souped up police force aiming weapons at protesters, that really chills that fundamental right to be an American and that fundamental right to speak out. And that strikes me and a lot of my colleagues in the veterans community as wrong.
What's that like for you to kind of like suddenly have this come into your mind?
There's a very jarring comparison when you see police forces in a city, whether it's your own or it's one that you see on the news, wearing the same gear and acting as if they are soldiers at home. It doesn't sit well, and it makes me wonder whether the militarization of our police has really gone too far.
It sounds like you think it has.
Yes, I do.
You were actually working with police in Iraq for some time. Tell us what you did differently when you were on foot patrol in Bakuba with your Iraqi police colleagues.
The biggest lessons we took away are some of the ones that are ingrained in the Army's counterinsurgency manual, which is that force is sometimes most useful when not used at all. And sometimes the most effective weapons are things like relationships and money for reconstruction and diplomacy. We were able to build relationships with the relevant political players in our part of Iraq And that had a more salutary effect on violence than trying to defeat the insurgents by killing or capturing them. We had to do some of that too. But in general, we were more successful the less force we used.
That was former Army Captain Philip Carter speaking with me today from Washington. For Christopher Dickey, it's not just the big weapons in Ferguson that caught his eye. Dickey is a foreign editor for the Daily Beast. He's based in France, but we happened to catch up with him in Washington. Christopher Dickey told me that the events in Ferguson have taken him back to the riots in the suburbs of Paris in 2005 in several respects.
When you have a situation where a population comes to feel as if it's occupied by a hostile force, even though that's the national or local police force, it creates a really dangerous environment. That's what happened in France in 2005, where a couple of kids were running away from police, hid out near an electrical transformer, and were electrocuted. The police were blamed, and all of a sudden, really, it felt like all of France was in flames. And I think that's a similar situation here. We don't know what happened with Michael Brown, but it certainly looks suspicious. We do know that the Ferguson police force over the years had become infamous for its abuse of different people that it picked up. So that's the kind of environment that creates trouble. I think the difference that you see is that there are a lot more weapons in the American environment on both sides.
Why are the police in France not as heavily armed as police here, do you think?
Because people don't have guns in France. You know, in the United States, you have literally millions of guns on the streets. The police have very mixed feelings about it, and if they're already in a situation where they feel the local population is hostile, then they go in very heavily armed. Often they're not carrying shotguns and pistols, certainly not revolvers like they used to. You even see them with AR-15s, M16-type guns in their cars. And that creates an environment that really looks like an occupying army and feels like one.
One of the things I have to ask you about, Christopher, that a lot of the coverage on Ferguson has pointed to is the lack of diversity in the police force. I mean, the majority of residents in the community are African American. The majority of the police force is Caucasian. I remember being in the suburbs of Paris covering the aftermath of those 2005 riots, and the optics at the local commissariat were almost entirely white police force, maybe one or two cops of North African origin, surrounded by a poor community of color. I'm just wondering, has much changed in France in terms of police diversity?
No, not a lot has changed there. There are a couple of critical differences, though. First of all, you have to remember that in France, it is a national police force. So what you've got is often people who are not only not from the same racial and ethnic background as the people living in the banlieue of Paris, for instance. They're not even from Paris. They're right from different parts of the country. And that certainly heightens the atmosphere in those neighborhoods of a foreign occupation, which is a bad thing. Now, in Ferguson, those cops may come from somewhere that's not right in Ferguson, but they don't come from very far away. They're more or less living in the neighborhood, which is one of the reasons that, of course, they were reluctant to identify the policeman who was involved in the shooting. Once they're identified, they're going to feel vulnerable in a situation that's as volatile as this.
The Ferguson story must give you some thoughts and just kind of wondering where things may be headed in France as you head back there.
Well, I think it does. And I think that it has made international headlines now. And while people are tending to say, well, you see, these things do happen in the United States, they also do look over their shoulders and say, is this something that could happen here? The first impulse is to say, that's those Americans. The second impulse is to say, what are we really doing to integrate communities that are marginalized in France? And the answer is not very satisfactory. In fact, things are tending to go in the wrong direction. The rise of really very far right-wing parties all over Europe who basically have built their political capital on thinly disguised racism and anti-immigrant policies.
Christopher Dickey is the foreign editor for The Daily Beast. Thanks, as always, Christopher.
Thank you, Marco.
If you want to find an example of an integrated police force, or the beginnings of it anyway, head to Nashville, Tennessee. The city is home to the largest Iraqi Kurdish community in the U.S., and it's where the world's Monica Campbell met Nashville's first Kurdish-American cop.
G.I. Suleiman's day starts with morning roll call.
Officer Arnold, you'll be 15.
Yes, sir.
Officer Suleiman, you'll be 16.
Sir.
Suleiman just turned 26. He's kind of lanky. His uniform hangs on him a bit. And he's new to the Nashville police force, just 2 years in.
1138 Second Avenue North.
I spend the day with him on patrol, and we talk about why he joined the force. He says it goes back to 2006. As the Kurdish community grew in Nashville, a group emerged called the Kurdish Pride Gang, mostly young kids whose parents were war refugees. Suleiman noticed that when the gang brought trouble to his neighborhood, nobody called the police.
I took this job to bridge the gap between not only the Kurdish community, but the Muslim community with the police department. I wanted to be that one guy that makes a difference.
Today, his patrol includes Nashville's toughest neighborhoods. We start by pulling into a gas station with a small grocery store. It's next to a large public housing project.
It's also a hotspot for drug addicts. How you doing, brother?
We meet Alex Saeed, the store manager.
I was born in the United States, but I was raised in Yemen. When I came back to this country, I didn't even know a letter A. Zero.
Yemenis and other Middle Easterners run a lot of convenience and liquor stores around here. It can be dangerous work.
The last few weeks, we have casualties around here, people being getting shot and stuff like that. So
Saeed keeps a tight watch on his shop. He stands on a crate in one aisle and drinks tea from a small glass. He's got a gun on his belt. So do all of his employees. Saeed likes Suleiman, the cop. He's the only officer he knows who's an immigrant and from the Middle East.
Brother Suleiman, knowing that he's Kurdish and Muslim also, make me feel good. He knows my culture and he knows my religions and belief, and I will assume that he respected it because he's carrying the same belief.
Officer Suleiman says Saeed and other Middle Easterners in the neighborhood are some of his best contacts. I ask him how he'd feel patrolling the city's Kurdish area. He says it'd be tricky.
We have a very small community. Something happens, everybody knows about. I mean, then you have to face your community and say, why you arrested this young Kurdish guy, or why did you do this and why did you do that?
But you have Latino officers who are out in Latino communities.
Yeah, but the Kurdish community is so small. Everybody knows everybody. You can go into a community and say somebody's name and everybody will raise their hand and say, yeah, I know him.
Still, he's the only Kurdish-speaking cop here. He says he gets calls from neighbors, Kurdish families, asking for advice about everything from domestic disputes to parking tickets. While I'm with him, though, the only personal call he gets is from his mom. She invites us over to eat. We make a quick visit. Suleiman's parents live in a middle-class area with brick homes and elm trees. In the living room, his father watches the Kurdish news channel. In the 80s, he was a Kurdish Peshmerga fighter. I ask him about the news now. His English is rough, so Suleiman translates.
Yeah, he said, we just want to control our border and defend our land. We're trying to push for independence.
Then dinner, rice and lamb, is served on the floor, traditional style. Suleiman has a quick bite before going back to work. And while he's busy with police work in Nashville, he's thinking a lot about Kurdistan. He visited recently, and his ties to the region are strong, down to his first name, G.I.
G.I. means mountaineer, and that came from my parents being refugees and fleeing northern Iraq, and I was born in the mountain region of Kurdistan.
Suleiman's shift ends at about 10 that night. He shows me something he's mentioned a few times, a Kurdish news report his cousin posted to Facebook. He's watched it over and over. It's about Peshmerga fighters in northern Iraq, wounded in a battle with Islamic State fighters. Suleiman's uncle is in the video. He's a ranking Peshmerga commander.
Yeah, that's Malka right there. He's been doing this since he was 14. It makes us feel proud that he's defending his country and his people.
What if you'd stayed in Kurdistan? Do you ever think about that?
Yeah, I think about that a lot. I mean, I would probably join the Kurdish Peshmerga forces, and we'd probably been right there beside him.
But he also makes it clear he's very happy here in the U.S., working as a cop, raising two young boys, and trying to keep his community here safer. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Nashville.
We have pictures of Officer Suleiman on the beat at PRI.org.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We've been telling you about the threat facing the Yazidi people of Iraq. There are around 500,000 in that country, or there were. Tens of thousands of them are on the run from the militants of the Islamic State, some still on Mount Sinjar. There is also a large community of Yazidis, the largest in the U.S., in Lincoln, Nebraska. Julie Khalaf is part of that community, and that's where she's been following the news of her people back in Iraq. I started by asking Julie how her family in Lincoln is dealing with the news.
They have put their life on the back burner, and they have been robbed of their livelihood. All they do now is just do meetings, do rallies, try to talk to the people back at home and try to see if the situation is getting any better.
And when you say robbed of their livelihood, we're talking the Yazidi community in Lincoln. Are they just so upset by what's going on in Iraq that they can't even go to work?
Some of them have quit their job. Some of them, when they do go to their job, anybody who talks to them, they just break down and cry. And some of them are so busy just texting and trying to connect with their family that they cannot focus at work. And, yeah.
And you're a teacher. And how's it affecting you personally right now? Can you kind of concentrate?
I concentrate more than others because I feel like there's more that we, Yazidi community over here, could do. And I'm just busy trying to arrange the next meeting, talk to the next humanitarian organization. So it's like I have few goals ahead of me, and that helps me deal with it. Otherwise, I would just be among all the others, just home, weeping over all that has happened, crying, and just be overwhelmed by all the responsibility we, the community here in Lincoln, are faced with, because we are the Yazidis' voices right now.
What is the latest that you've heard from your relatives, many of whom were stranded on top of the mountain?
A large number of them have made the 18-hour journey into Syria. But once they make it into Syria border, they're facing the death and horrific conditions don't end. They get into Syria after 18 hours of walking, and from there, they're packed into pickup trucks and whatever as if they're sardines, and then they have to go 3 more hours to get back into Iraq, into Zaho. But even there, whether it's Zaho or it's Duhok, their condition does not get any better. One of my relatives has made it to Duhok, and he says there's 700 of them now in a school. They're not getting any humanitarian aid, and they're not getting any kind of help.
So what goes through your mind when you hear about those conditions?
Me as an American, I worry that the humanitarian aid from here, the taxes and all that is going and helping, not the people who need help.
You're seeing it as going to the Peshmerga or whatever else it's going to, but not to the Yazidis.
It might be helping some of them, but a lot of them are not getting help, because even my aunt, who has finally gotten out of the being trapped inside Sinjar, has made it to a nearby refugee camp area in Zaho, and they supposedly live in camps and such, but it's basically a sheet of, I don't know what to call it, fabric or something like that, a flimsy thing.
Like a tarp.
Held by, exactly, they call that shelter. And then there's a lot of people who get from this mountain situation dehydrated, sick, shocked, broken legs, injury here and there. And they are seen maybe the first time, but there is no follow-up medical help. And then the mountain is one thing. Then there is the women who are held as hostage. We have person over here in Lincoln who talks to his sister, who's among the hundreds of people who are held hostage. She has managed to smuggle a phone with her, and she's talking about how they're right now dividing us into groups of young boys, elderly women, and then women. And I don't know what they're going to do with us. Another relative tells me, your women are being sold as merchandise for 250 dinars. And then there is the town of Kocho. It has 400 families, that's the estimate, about 5,000 people, 4,000 to 5,000. And they're telling them, convert now or you're going to be killed.
You grew up in a refugee camp in Syria, so you know what those people are going through. It's not fun. It's roughing it when you don't want to be roughing it.
It's actually, for me, where I lived compared to what they're living in, mine is kind of almost a good life. It was good life.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. Just remind us who the Yazidis are and why ISIS is targeting them, Julie.
ISIS people see Yazidis as apostates. They see them as devil worshippers. We see it, our teachings tell us it's one of the oldest religion. It has some ties to Zoroastrianism, and we believe in God and seven angels. I do not know too much about my religion, unfortunately, because just like all the other Yazidis, throughout our history, we have been persecuted. We have had to try to blend in and not bring attention to ourselves.
But you identify as Yazidi, right?
I mean, yes.
And you're American and you're Yazidi. You lived in Iraq for a while. Do you remember feeling different from other Iraqis because you were Yazidi?
I was 4 years old when we ran away and fled from Iraq to Syria. And I spent basically my childhood in Syrian refugee camps. I remember they would force us to read the Quran, and then when we would try to leave the class, at least that Quran class, sometimes we would get beating. And even though I was one of the top students, my grades would always be lower. This was in an elementary school. And then in middle school, if you did not take the Quran class, you would not pass. And yeah, sometimes I would wish that I was different religion because of that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just really curious, Julie, what the concept of home means to you. And is Lincoln home because of those families there, or just it will never feel that way?
Lincoln is home, but right now we're trying to help all the Yazidis get out of Iraq because Middle East is no longer place for Yazidis. But if we were never to go back there, it's like we're cut off our roots. And we don't want any Yazidis in Middle East. Middle East has proved that they cannot. They don't tolerate minorities, and minorities cannot survive among them. So we don't want any of them to be left there. But if we are not without Iraq, we feel like cut off our identity, and it's just really saddening.
Julie Khalaf, a Yazidi who lives in Lincoln, Nebraska, thanks very much for speaking with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. Sharks. Nothing to be scared of, right?
When you start to swim with these animals, you realize they're not after us. We're not on their menu.
Okay, I'll just take his word for it. Ahead, we'll speak with a photographer who spent 2 years getting the perfect shot of a great white, and you'll hear how you can negotiate without talking in the Middle East. That's ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. The medical relief agency Doctors Without Borders battles disease. Their doctors also work in war zones. So for the agency to say the Ebola outbreak in West Africa is like wartime, that's really ominous. Even more ominous, Ebola is now in Nigeria and a touchdown in Lagos, one of the biggest cities in the world. Our BBC colleague Tomi Oladipo is in Lagos, where passengers flying in and out are now being screened for Ebola.
Well, the officials at the Murtala International Airport have been screening passengers. You know, the passengers seem to be fairly calm. The officials brief them when they arrive and tell them why they're being screened. They have to fill some forms to list any possible symptoms of any illnesses that they've had, and they have to list that in the form. I saw them as well using thermometers to check people's temperatures just to be sure that nobody who's ill, especially with the Ebola virus, is going in without being checked.
Let's hear a bit about those precautions, because you spoke with one of the Nigerian health inspectors at the airport who described what they're actually doing.
We saw a passenger is coming in from Accra stating that he's being treated for typhoid. So we have to stop him so that we allow our medical team to review him.
Right. I've heard that in Monrovia, Liberia, pretty much all restaurants are enforcing hand washing. What kinds of precautions do you find people taking in Lagos?
I've seen that as well here a lot in Lagos. They have bottles of hand sanitizers and you have to, you know, squirt and wash your hands. So that's what you have a lot here. A lot of people generally taking precaution. Nigerians are generally concerned. There isn't, I wouldn't say the state of panic, but people are concerned. And everywhere you go, there seems to be, you know, this talk about what's going on and talk about how to stay safe.
We have to say that Lagos, Nigeria, almost has the same population as the countries of Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia combined. That makes your city a real potential petri dish for Ebola. Can you sense that concern about what it represents among the residents of this megalopolis?
Certainly. I mean, even now there's been a fourth death, including the first man who came in from Liberia. And there are those worries that if the virus was to come in to this densely populated, dirty, chaotic city, then it would just cause havoc. And that is the main worry. And the authorities really, I think that is their concern as well, which is why they're trying to contain the initial cases and make sure the virus doesn't spread beyond those people. Because if it does get out into the public, into the rest of Lagos, then it's almost unimaginable what would happen. The thing here is also because Nigeria's healthcare system, as much as it is better than what you have in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone, it faces severe challenges as well. And at the moment, you have a doctor's strike that has been going on for almost months now. In fact, the president just announced that 16,000 of those doctors will be sacked as a result of their staying away, especially during this crisis. So those are the challenges Nigeria faces at the moment. So it is a tough one for Nigerians themselves to face.
Yeah, I read about that firing of the 16,000 medical residents. That just seems insane right now when Nigeria would seem to need any capable physicians it can get.
The doctors have had their long-running battles with the government, many disputes revolving around their working conditions, revolving around pay and many other issues put together. But the question now is, if these doctors are given the sack, then what happens? Are you going to train fresh doctors? How are you going to go about recruiting so many doctors? But many people within the system reckon that the unions will be forced to come back to dialogue with the government. It doesn't mean that the doctors will all just go home and not have jobs. So far, there are isolation centers for the Ebola victims, and the government has been able to isolate them into one place. But if the number spiked, then that would be a whole different issue, especially now that these doctors are not around.
Tommy, how are you kind of adjusting your own personal lifestyle in response to the Ebola outbreak?
As for us, as journalists, as reporters, you know, going to some of these hospitals, you can't be sure what you're going to meet there. So we definitely, even though you're covering the story, you have to keep your distance, physical distance, at least from these places.
Our friend with the BBC in Lagos, Nigeria, Tommy Oladipo, thank you for your time. Stay safe.
You're welcome. Cheers.
You can't negotiate with the disease, and that's partly why Ebola is so scary. And that's also why there is some hope in negotiating your way out of a war. You can talk to the enemy, but how do you get bitter enemies to sit down and negotiate? Well, also by talking. But when the enemies are Israel and Hamas, they can't talk to each other, not right now anyway, after Gaza. So the talks right now between Israel and Hamas are indirect. Gershon Baskin knows all about this. He helped get Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit released from captivity in Gaza 3 years ago through indirect talks. I asked Mr. Baskin, first off, what do indirect talks actually mean?
Well, indirect means that I was not a representative of the government of Israel. So I was a go-between between the government of Israel and Hamas because both the government of Israel wouldn't talk directly with Hamas and Hamas wouldn't talk directly with the government of Israel. So I was, as they call it in these kind of negotiations, there was an element of deniability involved. They could say that they weren't negotiating directly.
And why would you want to deny a sense of progress?
Well, you want to deny that you're talking to someone who's sworn to your non-existence. It would be breaking enormous political codes if these two sides that deny each other's right to exist were to acknowledge each other by talking directly. That's exactly what's happening now in the negotiations in Cairo, where you have Hamas sitting in a delegation of the Palestinians, but the Israelis are not talking directly with them. In fact, the Egyptians aren't talking directly to them either.
Wow. So how indirect are the parties ensured that the talks will be? I mean, are we talking about keeping negotiators in separate hotels, or, you know, they wouldn't want to have these awkward moments in the elevator if they were in the same hotel?
Well, in Cairo, during the talks, the final rounds of talks for the release of the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit back in 2011, the talks were taking place mostly in an Egyptian intelligence base. And the two delegations were in two separate buildings, and the Egyptian mediators were going back and forth. There were times that the Israeli officials who were there told me that they saw the Hamas delegates walking by the room, and one of them even tried to make eye contact, but it was not successful.
So do the governments of either side have kind of their own negotiators, or is it essentially kind of proxies like you were?
Well, no. These talks that are going on now in Cairo are officials. The Israeli delegation is being headed by an official from the Ministry of Defense, and on his team is the National Security Advisor, the head of the Israeli Shin Bet, the Israeli Security Agency, and a government official who's in charge of the government activities, with the rank of general, in charge of government activities in the occupied territories. On the Palestinian side, the delegation is being headed by a representative of President Abbas from the Fatah side. There are other Fatah people in the delegation. Then there are representatives of the other Palestinian factions, the Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, one or two other people, the Communist Party. So it's an all-Palestinian delegation representing all the political parties on the Palestinian side.
And yet, politically, things are still very fraught among the Palestinians. There's still this internal struggle between Hamas and Fatah. And just to remind listeners for shorthand, we can say Hamas is the party of Gaza and Fatah that of the West Bank. So how are these talks affecting Palestinian unity? Are they on the same page?
Well, at the end of April, the Fatah and the Hamas movements agreed to enter into final negotiations for the formation of a national reconciliation government, which they completed in May. And President Abbas announced the formation of a national reconciliation government, which would not be with members of either Fatah or Hamas, but be supported by all Palestinian factions. And that is, in fact, the makeup of the delegation that's going there. And the agreement, I assume, that will be signed in Cairo between the warring parties will be on the Palestinian side, the representatives of the National Reconciliation Government.
So what's in it for the government in Egypt to stick themselves in the middle of these warring parties right now?
Oh, that's a very good question. Egypt is trying to reassert itself as a leader in the Arab world after the fall of the Muslim Brotherhood, the takeover of Egypt by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who fought his war against the Muslim Brotherhood. And Hamas is really a part of that Muslim Brotherhood. He doesn't want on his border in Sinai a warring party and a war raging on that could destabilize the streets of Egypt. So this is in his interest to make sure that Gaza is quiet. Egypt does not also want to end up taking any responsibility for Gaza, and they're very careful to maintain their position as mediators but not as stakeholders.
Mr. Baskin, based on your own experience in indirect talks, describe what you imagine the atmosphere to be right now in Cairo. I mean, would folks be yelling at each other, or is it kind of more civil?
No, it's quite civil, and the Egyptians are very, very qualified and experienced mediators. And the fact that the sides are not sitting in the same room means that there's no screaming going across. The Israelis have gone back and forth between Cairo and Jerusalem, and the Palestinians are busy consulting with their folks back in Gaza, in Beirut, in Doha, in Ramallah as well, of course.
It almost sounds like it's a time out for children to just sit down and look at each other.
Well, it is kind of a timeout right now. Often these negotiations look like kindergarten. There's a lot of honor involved and a lot of who takes the first step and who makes the first compromise. Neither side wants to give a victory to the other side, particularly when they have such arch enemies involved like Israel and Hamas.
Gershon Baskin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The world has been all over the situation along the Texas-Mexico border this week. Another story now about how justice is playing out along the border. Migrants often languish for months or years waiting for trials. In parts of Texas, trials can be pretty swift. Too swift, say critics who call the process a cattle call. The world's Jason Margolis has our story, and you can't record in courthouses, so Jason describes a scene in a McAllen, Texas courtroom.
27 people are awaiting criminal charges. Nearly all are Mexican nationals. Many claim to have spent years in America. Some say they grew up here. They've all been caught recently entering or re-entering the U.S., crossing the Rio Grande River illegally. They sit shoulder to shoulder on benches. Most wear T-shirts. Their shackles are piled in the back of the courtroom. The judge, Peter Ormsby, reads them all their rights together, the right to remain silent, to a trial, to an attorney. The men and a few women wear headphones to hear an interpreter speak Spanish. Then, one by one, the people rise and the judge addresses them individually, but asks the same questions. Did you knowingly enter the U.S. illegally? Do you understand the charge? How do you wish to plead? Culpable, they all say. Guilty. Each exchange takes about 30 seconds. Then the judge goes back down the line. A government prosecutor makes a sentencing recommendation dependent on prior offenses. The public defender asks for something lighter. The judge settles on something in between. Most are sentenced between 1 and 3 months in prison. Within 90 minutes, 26 of the 27 people are off to jail. This system of fast-tracking these immigration cases started 9 years ago.
It was put forth under the Bush administration as a way to increase prosecutions.
Ruthie Epstein is a legislative policy analyst with the ACLU in Washington. The latest Justice Department numbers show more than half of all government criminal prosecutions are against people violating immigration and customs laws. Go visit a federal prison. You'll find nearly as many people serving time for immigration offenses as drug offenses. Epstein says migrants are being tried the wrong way.
We have a system. We have a civil system that is in place to deal with unauthorized migration. The administration has an opportunity to make a choice whether to funnel people into the criminal justice system using taxpayer dollars to incarcerate people who are going to be deported anyway, or just to send them straight into the civil system where the ultimate outcome of their case, if it's deportation, will happen regardless.
The federal government began pushing migrants into the criminal system here in Texas with this reasoning. If migrants know they'll almost certainly face jail time, they'll stop trying to cross the border illegally. The program is called Operation Streamline. Basically, if you're caught sneaking across the border, you're going to criminal court and almost certainly to jail. Zero tolerance. It's been used off and on in districts in Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. So, does it work? The ACLU says it doesn't. A study for Congress showed a lower recidivism rate for people prosecuted under Streamline in 2012, but there are a lot of variables. We contacted the Department of Homeland Security, but they didn't respond to our emails. A Justice Department spokesperson said they didn't have the statistics we were requesting. So let's consider one example. I saw a man in federal criminal court in Brownsville, Texas, who claimed he came up from Mexico to help his 4 kids here in the U.S. get ready for school. He got caught on the border, and a judge sent him back to Mexico, not prison, but said if he showed up in his court again, he'd get at least a year in jail and up to 2.5 years. Hector Garza is a federal public defender in Brownsville. We went to lunch, and I asked him if that man was likely to come back again illegally.
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, I would do it if my children are here and they keep deporting me. My children are here. My wife is here. I'm going to try to be with them. And we see that this all the time.
I have no doubt he'll come back. You know, you take me away from my kids and tell me that I can't cross this line, damn straight I'm going to cross that line. And I'll cross it many, many, many times.
That's private immigration attorney Jody Goodwin from nearby Harlingen, Texas. She took me on a drive to visit a few courts. She says she's not an open borders person, but she says there has to be some discretion about who gets sent before the judge.
95% of the cases that I see are individuals that are coming across just to work, to feed their families, to reunite with their families. Not everybody should be prosecuted. There's only a finite amount of cases that can be processed through the federal courts. There's only a finite amount of resources for U.S. attorneys, a finite amount of resources for public defenders, for court reporters, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
There's also a finite amount of resources for what comes next in the process. U.S. taxpayers are paying an estimated $1 billion a year to incarcerate people convicted on criminal immigration charges. Many are housed in private, for-profit prisons. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
And this is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. You're either nice and cool right now or roasty toasty, depending on where you're listening to us. You can thank electricity for that. Chances are you're in a spot where you don't have to worry when you flick on a light or the AC. Our friend Deepak Singh doesn't usually have to worry about that, but he's with his parents this summer in Lucknow, India.
In my formative years, from mid-80s to early 90s in Lucknow, India, when we lost power, all the boys of our three-story apartment complex gathered on the landing of the stairwell and played chess and carom during the day. And when the sun went down, we went up on the rooftop to play cricket. The girls and young women came out of their homes and sat on the balcony. To while away the time, they played Antakshari, a game of dueling Bollywood songs. For the past decade, I've been living in the United States. Right now, I'm spending the summer with my parents in India. And I realized how much time my parents spent thinking about electricity. My parents now live in a much bigger house than we did when I was a kid. They also own three air conditioners and several ceiling fans, among other gadgets. To keep them all running, they have something called a UPS, an uninterruptible power supply, basically a giant car battery, which stores electricity when the power is on. During load shedding, the UPS can run a few ceiling fans and light bulbs in the house. The battery life in the UPS is very precious to us. It is like a single bottle of water to be shared with six friends who are stranded in a desert with no water in sight for miles. Every drop of water counts, and so does every iota of charge in the UPS. The family tries to stay in one room under one ceiling fan until the power comes back. When we do have power, we watch the electricity voltage in a way that is not unlike a heart specialist who monitors the uneven spikes in his patient's cardiogram, or a trader tracking a volatile stock. As soon as the light flickers, everyone's faces turn grim. When I'm in the US, I take it for granted that when I flick the switch, the light bulb will come on, the coffee machine will work, that I never have to reset the clock in the microwave. But even after living in the United States for so many years, when I get a call from the electricity company to inform me a day in advance about a possible power outage for 5 minutes at 4 o'clock in the morning, it never fails to amaze me.
Deepak Singh is the author of Chasing America, the story of his journey from India to the United States. As someone who surfs in Massachusetts waters, the home of Jaws, I saw something in last week's New York Times magazine that kind of freaked me out, but it was also incredibly beautiful. It was a photo of a great white shark breaching. In other words, flying out of the water. The picture was taken by Michael Mueller. He travels the world to take photos of all types of sharks. And earlier today, I had a chance to speak to him in between his assignments. He said that sometimes it takes years to get the perfect image, like that shot of that shark breaching.
You are towing a decoy seal behind a boat that's moving on the water, and the decoy's about 40, 50 feet behind the boat, and you tow it around the ocean, so you're moving all constantly, and you have to keep your camera, pointed right at that tiny little piece of plastic out behind the boat, and the shark, there's no warning, it just, boom, explodes out of the water. So you have to be totally ready.
Michael, you're seemingly committed to sharks. You go all over the world to just take shark photos. And what's different with you is you do this when you're in the water without a cage. That seems kind of crazy.
Yes, I've traveled the world documenting sharks for over the last decade. It's a definite passion of mine. I'm always cage free. You really only need a cage, in my opinion, with great whites on the surface when you're feeding them. When you start to swim with these animals, you realize they're not after us. We're not on their menu. You know, a number of people, including my wife, you know, came on a trip with me, and the whole time she's like, oh, I don't know why we're doing this. It's so irresponsible. You know, if something happens. By the second dive, I thought she was going to jump off and grab onto the dorsal fin and swim away.
The fact that you photograph sharks without a cage, it is part of your own conservation promotion of sharks, isn't it?
Well, yes, without a doubt. They are killing 100 million sharks around the world every year. 100 million. And these are, you know, animals that are on the top of a very, very fragile ecosystem in our ocean. It's just mind-boggling. And it's scary because so many of these creatures are, you know, endangered or on the, you know, facing extinction. You go into certain waters now and there's just jellyfish. You know, there's just jellyfish because, you know, you take out the top predator, it's like a domino effect, you know, the balance that happens underneath that.
A lot of those sharks are killed for the delicacy shark's fin soup in Asia. You think anybody has ever gone after a great white for its fin for soup?
Without a doubt. In Africa, they get paid a very large sum for great white jaws and teeth and fins. But at the same time, you know, it can feed an entire, you know, a great white shark can feed a village. And we see it in Mogadishu and different places in Africa for a month, you know, 2 months, which is fine and great. I have no issues with that. And I have no issues with shark fin soup. I just have the issue with the balance that, you know, 100 million sharks don't need to be killed for a soup. It's just like bluefin tuna that's, you know, on the brink of extinction. We need to allow these animals time to replenish their stocks and not push it to where we push everything as humans, you know, to the brink that we aren't going to have them anymore. I have three daughters. I'm fearful that aren't ever going to be able to see some of these creatures.
You do take celebrity photographs as well. I looked at your Instagram feed. There's Cate Blanchett, Ian McKellen, also Lil Wayne flipping the bird. What's scarier, sharks or celebrities?
Scared. Well, fear. I don't really get scared. I mean, they're
you're,
both.
You're thinking about it, though.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's scarier, sharks or celebrities? I mean, the celebrities definitely aren't, you know, scary. The people that are around them sometimes can be a bit of a challenge. But yeah, I've been shooting actors and you know, musicians and sports for close to 30 years. It's how I make my living. You know, sharks is a passion, like I've said. I make my living doing movie posters and ad campaigns. And if you're listening to this, you've definitely seen my images before. You probably just don't know that I was the one that took them.
Photographer Michael Muller, he's one guy who doesn't need a bigger boat. Thank you very much, Michael. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've got some of Michael Muller's amazing Instagram photos at PRI.org. Here's something else you may not know about great whites. They like heavy metal, not the bars of the cage, the music. At least according to a charter boat operator in Australia, shark tour guide Matt Waller doesn't throw chum in the water to attract sharks. Waller says sharks become less aggressive when he plays AC/DC for them. Some sharks even rub their snouts against the cage speakers. So some AC/DC is in order. Here's If You Want Blood, You Got It. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Have yourselves a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation. By the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor. The PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation. by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include the Rose Family Fund, the Tagney-Jones Family Fund, and Roger Hale and Nora Hall, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.